Andrew Talks to Chefs is an independent podcast. For current and past episodes, Andrew's blog, contact information, and more, please visit andrewtalkstochefs.com. To support us, please visit patreon.com/andrewtalkstochefs. Enjoy the show!
Andrew Talks to Chefs is brought to you in part by San Pellegrino Sparkling Natural Mineral Water. For more than 120 years, San Pellegrino has been inspiring people to savor life and tasteful moments around the table. As chefs and restaurants have evolved worldwide, San Pellegrino has always been there to complement the food they serve, the moments they create, and to support them in both good and challenging times. Learn more at sanpellegrino.com.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Hoonie Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
There was a void that I didn't know how to fill. The work I was doing, I didn't really understand how the work was providing really any value necessarily to anyone at that point. We're generating all these documents, all these presentations, and it just felt like at the end of the day, like, what are we doing here? Mm-hmm. And I knew there needed to be some sort of change. At that point, I didn't know what the change was going to be. And it wasn't necessarily that I thought, okay, I know I'm going to do cooking now. I just knew that I needed to do something about it sooner than later.
That is the voice of Dennis Ngo of D&D Restaurant in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. Dennis is our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses to make some sense of this. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. This is going to be a very short introduction at the end of a very busy week. But for a number of reasons, I wanted to get this show up before the weekend. Our feature guest today is Dennis Ngo of D&D Restaurant in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. That is a Vietnamese restaurant, as many of you listening may know. Dennis has a really interesting story. I really enjoyed meeting him. He is a career changer who went from a corporate job in which he was very successful to the professional kitchen, starting as a dishwasher, get this, in his 30s. He is now the chef of his own restaurant, D&D, a Vietnamese restaurant in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. He is originally from Houston, Texas. We get into his entire backstory, his family's backstory, his corporate life and how he got out of it, his bumpy start as a chef, and then, of course, his tremendous success currently at D&D. The name means let's go eat in Greenpoint. I really enjoyed meeting Dennis. He's a super nice guy. He's smart. He's very direct. We had a very open conversation for someone I'd never met before. And I also have to thank him publicly for the very kind words he shared with me. Dennis is a longtime listener, not only to this show, but also to the show I used to do with my old podcasting partner, Jimmy Bradley. He's read at least one of my books. Dennis has, and I felt very flattered and very humbled and honored by some of the thoughts he shared with me, both by email before we met up and then when we met in person. I also need to let all of you know that this interview was arranged by our promotional partner, San Pellegrino, and Dennis is currently participating in something we talked about on this show about a year ago, the first time it made its way through New York. But San Pellegrino, during the pandemic, started doing a program called Destination Dining. And what they do is they pair chefs in different cities, and it's essentially a culinary exchange program. A chef in one city does a dish from the restaurant in the other city and vice versa. This has been going on currently in New York for the past 2 weeks, and starting today, this show is dropping on Friday, October 29th, 2021. Dennis is going to be doing two dishes from Night Market in Los Angeles, California, and Night Market in exchange, we'll be doing two dishes from D&D. You can start enjoying those again today, Friday, October 29th. In the interview, which we recorded the other day, Dennis refers to the program taking place at his restaurant, quote, next week. He meant over the forthcoming week that actually begins today. And you can learn more about the entire program and its history and future at the link on our website at andrewtalkstochefs.com and at the link for today's episode at Apple Podcasts, where the links are also functional. This is a bit of a redundant note given what I just said, but as always, our feature interview here on Andrew Talks to Chefs is presented by San Pellegrino. Whether in life or on the plate, every chef has a story to tell. San Pellegrino proudly helps them share those stories in their restaurants and right here on Andrew Talks to Chefs. The perfect complement to great food and meaningful interactions, San Pellegrino is delighted to be a part of the conversation. Learn more at sampellegrino.com. And with that, let's get to my conversation with Dennis Ngo. Here you go. Just to set the stage, we're at your restaurant. It is the morning. The stools are up on the bar. Mm-hmm. We had to like arrange the tables for ourselves. There's mm-hmm. people prepping in the back. Mm-hmm. I've never gotten tired of this time in a restaurant. And we just met for the first time. We'd never even emailed or DM'd anything until the other day. Mm-hmm. Before we get into your story, why don't we get this out of the way right now, since we don't know each other previously. Tell us about your participation in this program with San Pellegrino and what you'll be doing here.
So our friends at San Pellegrino have set up an event in partnership with Night Market in Los Angeles. It's called Destination Dining. And we're going to be trading two of our signature dishes. Night Market will be sending over their cow soy and their crispy rice salad. And in return, we're sending our grilled rice paper pizza dish. I named it after my favorite pizza spot in Bushwick called Ops. The pizza that they're doing, the grilled rice paper pizza that they're doing, is inspired by the Cicero pizza from Ops. So it's a shit ton of alliums on there. So ours has some pickled onions, some fried shallots, and some roasted onions on ours.
Great.
And we'll be doing it this upcoming Friday. It's going to be going on for a week. It's a fun exchange. I'd never met the Night Market team previously, so this is a fun opportunity for us to collaborate and work with our peers in the industry. So really thankful that San Pellegrino offered this opportunity to us, and it's a really exciting, fun challenge for my team.
Great. Thank you for all that.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get to it. You have a backstory that's it's like my favorite kind of chef backstory. I don't want to lump you into like a category, but you're the career changer.
Yeah.
You know, this is something that's less common today, although it's still not an unusual thing, but it was at one time in the U.S., certainly everybody in the almost was a career changer, because it wasn't something you would grow up naturally thinking you would do, you know, as a goal, right?
Right.
But it still happens. And I'm always fascinated by how people find their way to turning a passion into their life's work.
Yeah.
So before we get to all of that, let's talk a little bit about your childhood.
Sure.
So you grew up in Houston, Texas. Is that accurate?
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about where in Houston and what your parents did and what your young years were like.
Sure. So, you know, my parents are refugees from Vietnam. You know, we grew up in the southwest of Texas. My parents went to school in Austin, Texas. So they went to UT. And then we ended up moving to Houston. So I grew up in the southwest portion of Houston in an area that's predominantly Vietnamese. So I grew up surrounded by the culture of Vietnamese food, Vietnamese language. But funnily enough, that was something that I rejected as a young person.
On what basis?
Well, you know, I just wanted to fit in with everybody.
You wanted
to
assimilate.
Yeah, I wanted to assimilate. I wanted to be just like everyone else. I wanted to eat the same foods like everyone else was eating around me. So it wasn't till much later in my life that food became something that I became very passionate about.
How big a role did it play in home life?
Not much in my early years. Both my parents were working parents. So a lot of times it was my sister and I kind of fending for ourselves after we got home from school. So it was whatever we could make that was easy, or whatever my mom could put together after she got home from work. It wasn't until college that food became something more than just something to eat. And it was something that I became interested in and wanted to learn more about.
Before we move away, though, from your Houston years, what kind of kid were you? Introverted, extroverted, athletic, bookish? Like, how do you remember yourself as a kid?
I still feel like these days I'm a social introvert. I can do well in social settings, but I generally like to keep to myself. I don't really do well in large crowds. But, you know, I remember, you know, my younger years, pretty standard stuff. You know, there was nothing outside the ordinary. I had a really loving household. Parents gave me all the support that I could possibly need, encouraged me in any endeavors that I was interested in. But we're always insistent that I keep the straight, narrow path in terms of what my studies were, whether it was something in the engineering field or in the medical field. So when I decided to pivot into cooking later on in my life, it was a bit of a challenge in terms of our relationship and reconciling that with my parents.
So this is something I wanted to ask you about, but I was at some point, but I'll go to it right now since you just brought it up. I'm always loath to combine different Asian backgrounds into the umbrella category of Asian.
Sure.
But I've noticed a lot of people I've interviewed and a lot of friends of mine who are of different, you know, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Vietnamese, they do group themselves that, you know, they do tend to speak very generally sometimes.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, because I haven't interviewed a lot of people with a Vietnamese background, but a number, especially of people I've interviewed Korean, right? Mm-hmm. Hoonie Kim is mm-hmm. one, David Shim from Coat,
yeah.
Beverly Kim in Chicago. Going into the culinary profession was oftentimes an incredibly painful decision in terms of how it was received by the family. I mean, a couple of the people I just mentioned, one of their parents didn't talk to them like for a year.
Yeah.
Before we talk about how your ultimate decision was received, can you just talk to me about the you mentioned a couple of professions, right? These are the ones that come up all the time. You know, Hoonie once said to me, you know, you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer.
Yeah.
And if you're a screw up, you'd be an accountant. You know, like that was the bottom of the barrel, right?
Yep.
But what kind of pressure was on you in that regard as a kid?
Yeah, you know, as a kid, I did not realize there was any other opportunities for myself besides these very narrow pathways that my parents had insisted that I pursue.
It was almost like an arranged marriage.
Yeah,
but
a little bit.
But professionally.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't until much later in life and into college that I was like, when I was at UT myself, that I realized there's many different career paths here. There's artistic endeavors, there's creative endeavors that never really presented to me as a viable career path for myself growing up. And when you're surrounded in that kind of infrastructure of these are the things that we need you to do, it never came to my mind that this was a potential opportunity. So my mind was always focused on these set career paths that my parents had approved for.
And with food not being particularly important in your home.
So first off, I'll correct you. Food was definitely important in the
home.
Oh,
it was?
Yeah. So it just wasn't that we had a home-cooked meal every single day
of
the
week. Oh, I see. Okay.
So yes, food was definitely still an important aspect of my upbringing and was how I learned about my culture. The thing is, I did not necessarily appreciate it as a young person at that time about how much food would come into my life later on and how important it was for me in terms of my identity as a Vietnamese American.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. So, but yeah, you know, I grew up in an area that in the beginning was very strongly populated by a lot of Vietnamese people. Houston itself, especially the Southwest area, is a very culturally diverse area. So in addition to Vietnamese, there's lots of Southeast Asians, a lot of Hispanics. So I grew up in a very rich cultural area that exposed me to a lot of different things as a young person.
Texas is a big black hole of confusion for me.
Yeah.
We all know the stereotypes of Texas, you know, don't mess with Texas and all this kind of stuff. I don't want to get into the nuts and bolts of this at all, but, you know, the two spectrums of politics that were represented through the well-known politicians, you know, Beto O'Rourke on one side, Ted Cruz on the other. I've never spent time in Texas. I've never been in Texas beyond changing flights in one of the airports.
Sure.
I feel like to really ever get it, I need to go rent a car and spend 2 weeks driving around. But, you know, the way people do tend to talk about it is that the large metropolitan centers, the Houstons, the Dallases, even a smaller place like Austin, mm-hmm. which is considered like a hipster hub at this point, mm-hmm. that these are very kind of open, diverse, vibrant communities. Mm-hmm. You're nodding as I say this. What this is building to is my question is, growing up Vietnamese American in Houston specifically, was that, I mean, you talked about wanting to assimilate. I don't consider that necessarily something that would be a response to prejudice or intolerance or anything like that. Was it fairly comfortable for you growing up coming from the heritage that you do?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Does that question make sense?
Yeah, no, totally. You know, I didn't experience anything as a child or as a youth that people might stereotype certain areas of Texas about. We lived in an area, my parents worked very hard to make sure that we lived in an area that provided everything that we could possibly need and that was very comfortable and was very open to all walks of life.
So you were welcome in different social circles at school and
100%.
Stuff like that.
I was at a school that was maybe 50% Caucasian and the rest was Southeast Asian Hispanic. Had access to all different types of cultures, learned about different cultures, even as a young person.
And what about something I'm always curious to know is, was there any kind of like physical pursuit in your childhood? Were you athletic at all? Were you on any teams or did you play pickup sports?
I mean, no, like I always aspired to playing athletic sports, but you know, obviously the podcast you can't see, but I'm a very skinny, smaller guy. So, you know, while I aspired to playing basketball, that was something that I can never do even at a school level. So, you know, the way I like to think of it these days, because I have a keen interest in team sports. I love watching team sports and cooking. You know, I think a lot of chefs have said that is the ultimate team sport. And I think that's why I enjoy cooking so much. You have to work together as a team. So even though I never got to play team sports, I feel like as I've gotten older and now that I have a restaurant, I am playing a team sport day in and day out. And I get the same highs and enjoyment, I think, when I watch a football team succeed. I get that same high when my team succeeds and we're able to execute a service that we all feel really proud about.
So you, without any kind of ambition or spark toward cooking professionally, I still don't quite, I've heard you in other interviews kind of amusingly talk about you not getting it yourself, but I'm sure you get it more than me. Talk about the career path you did start down and which you did until you were in your 30s.
Following my parents' wishes, you know, I studied business at school. And I graduated with a business degree.
From?
And ended up graduating from the University of Houston. So started University of Texas and then graduated from University of Houston with a business degree. And then I started working at Accenture, which was a management information systems consulting company, one of the bigger consulting companies. And I did that for, I think, about 7 years, all throughout my 20s. After about the seventh year, you know, I was up for a middle management position and was traveling all over the United States. So, you know, my week consisted of Sunday nights flying out to wherever they had stationed me, and then Thursdays flying back to Houston.
You'd be on a project for a certain period of time. It could be months, potentially years.
Yeah, months, years. So
that's the consulting life.
Yeah,
that's and then you come back, and that's like instead of going to like Accenture's office, you go to your client's office. Yeah. You're embedded with them. You're analyzing things, giving advice, all that, and then you come home for the weekend. The commute is like usually a flight. Accurate?
Totally accurate. Yeah. It was a great experience for me coming right out of college. It kind of mimicked that college life of work hard, play hard. You had a bunch of 20-year-olds all in a hotel, all close together.
COVID.
Yeah, no COVID. Didn't really know anyone in the city because you're all transplants as well. You're all coming from different areas of the United States. So inevitably, you're after work, you're playing hard because there's nothing else left to really do. It really ran the wide spectrum of places they would staff you. And I think that was probably the most frustrating aspect of it because I had little control of where I was going. After 7 years, I was up for middle management. And quickly realized that didn't think that this was the path forward for myself. Just couldn't really imagine taking that next step in this career path. And just seeing what my manager was doing at the time and how it was impacting his life. Because it was great coming out of college to be doing the traveling. But for the long term, I didn't see that as something that was sustainable for myself. I was already starting to feel disconnected with friends and family just leading this lifestyle. So I knew there had to be some sort of change.
Did you feel, it's such a leading question, right? Given what you ended up doing, but not having had to like stifle that impulse, right? Because you were unaware of it.
Yeah.
Was there some kind of an emptiness that you felt with that work? Was there some, because, you know, I know you're a listener. We talked before. This comes up a lot. You know, I sometimes am envious of people who don't have a creative impulse, who are happy to just go make money and, you know, have the weekends off and buy a nice house, you know, depending on what you're doing for a living. You know, the creative impulse is a burden in a lot of ways. But it seems like you didn't have that burden, but did you sense like some kind of a void? Did you feel unfulfilled? You're nodding yes as I say this, but just how would you answer that question?
I think exactly what you said. I think there was a void that I didn't know how to fill, but I knew that this was, like I said, not a sustainable path forward. You know, it's just like the work I was doing. I didn't really understand how the work was providing really any value necessarily to anyone at that point. You know, like we're generating all these documents, all these presentations, and it just felt like at the end of the day, like, what are we doing here? I didn't feel like the work I was doing was very meaningful. It just didn't seem like something that I could just foresee myself spending the next 5 years doing. Mm-hmm. And I knew there needed to be some sort of change. At that point, I didn't know what the change was going to be. And it wasn't necessarily that I thought, okay, I know I'm going to do cooking now. I just knew that there needed to be a change and I needed to do something about it sooner than later.
Yeah, I mean, it almost in the terms you describe it, I don't want to get like overly dramatic about it, but it seems like you kind of decided you were going to embark on a quest of sorts.
Yeah.
Maybe not one that involved like, you know, hiking through the desert and this kind of thing, but at least looking into other things, spending time just thinking about other things.
Yeah, I mean, it was a personal journey of just personal growth. And, you know, with my upbringing, you know, and being on that very narrow career path, until I got to that point, I never considered that there was another option. So this was the first time in my life that my eyes were kind of open and that I saw that I don't have to necessarily be doing this anymore. I have options and there's other people doing these things and being very successful at it. There's no reason why I can't be doing this.
Were there other things besides cooking that you contemplated?
No, you know, hospitality was the first thing that kind of piqued my interest. Fortunately for myself, it's what stuck.
Yeah. What was the gateway to that? If you can trace it to any one thing?
No, I can. At this point in my career, I'm working mostly for financial services clients in the Northeast. So I'm flying a lot from Houston to New York. So I convinced my manager at the time to go ahead and relocate me from Houston to New York because, hey, yeah, I'm flying here every week. Let's save the company some money. They have an office here. So I was like, I'll save you guys some money. I've always wanted to live in New York. You know, this is a win-win situation for everybody. So they agree. They move me up to New York, and I get this tiny shithole in the East Village. I'm living on Fifth Street and Second Avenue, and this is right around the time that noodle bars opened, and then sambars opened. And you know, with my schedule, I'm coming back home on Thursdays from wherever I'm at.
You're talking specifically Momofuku.
Yeah.
When Momofuku, you say noodle bar and sambar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this is when sambar had just launched their late night menu, and it was helmed by Chef Tien Ho, who's also Vietnamese, who's also from Texas. And I know all this information. I'm reading Eater all the time while I'm away. This is when they're doing the SOM stuff during the day and it's not working out. And David Chang starts to like, well, fuck it. I'm going to start doing this late night stuff. It's great because I get home at 10 o'clock from the airport. I book it straight over to SOM Bar and I get to sit down and have this great late night meal. I'm watching this Vietnamese chef and I don't know any other Vietnamese chefs. This is the first chef that I've seen that's Vietnamese cooking food that's not necessarily Vietnamese. At this point, I'm thinking you can only cook food that you grew up with. This is a Vietnamese chef cooking Korean food, Vietnamese food, French food, and doing it at a very high level. And I remember sitting at the bar. I remember seeing David Chang there as well at the time. And he kind of admonishes a young line cook because he couldn't shuck oysters correctly. And for whatever reason, I'm watching all this happen in front of me. And it just really resonates with me. It really vibes with me.
Just on an animal level.
Yeah. I'm just like, I love the dance that's going on around me. I love the energy. I love this feedback that you're getting directly. Yes, you're doing it right. No, you're doing it wrong. Here's how you fix it. I love that kind of immediate feedback. And for whatever reason, that night, I remember eating just this wonderful meal by Chef Tien. And I'm just like, wow, this seems like an interesting industry. You know, I'm really discovering all the food in New York, the restaurant scene here, and just really falling in love with the hospitality industry overall. Not knowing anything about it because I'd never worked in hospitality in any capacity previously, but just knowing that this seems really fun and exciting. Why can't I try to do this? And, you know, like I said, I see a Vietnamese chef doing it. There's no reason why I can't do this. So let's give this a shot.
I'm struck that you a couple of times now have used the word hospitality. You didn't say cooking. You didn't say chef. You said hospitality.
Yeah.
But it seems like it was the kitchen that most appealed to you. But it also sounds like you had kind of like a holistic interest.
Yeah.
Like in the whole package. Like it wasn't just what was happening in the kitchen that came out on the plate, but the whole experience of the restaurant, the service piece. Is that accurate?
Yeah, 100%. In the beginning, I wasn't sure which area in hospitality that I would want to give it a shot in. Not having worked in hospitality previously, I was open to all areas, whether it was front of house serving or there was the kitchen. No area was really giving me a strong pull quite yet. But then, you know, I realized that like I said, I'm an introvert, so maybe that's probably not the best spot for me speaking to guests all the time. So then, you know, quickly I realized that maybe the back of house would be where my first stop would be. And if it didn't work out, that's fine. There's still other opportunities in the hospitality industry that I could pursue. But I decided, just knowing my personality and my aversion to wanting to talk all the time, I felt like, I think most cooks and most chefs are kind of introverts to begin with, and they want to keep to themselves.
I don't want to make you self-conscious, yeah, but I'm so struck that you keep describing yourself as an introvert. I mean, you seem complete. I mean, you're not the, listen, I'm kind of the same way.
Yeah.
You know, I got nervous before I came to interview you.
Yeah.
I've done a couple of 100 interviews. You know, I'm very happy at home.
Yeah.
I'm super comfortable in group situations where I know everybody.
Yep.
But ask me to show up at a party solo, you know, like where I may not know people. And it's like, I hate it.
Yeah.
It seems like you're kind of similar. You have your friends. You're not like a loner.
No.
But small talk, that kind of thing.
Yeah, no. You know, like I think the word I hear a lot of days, I'm a social introvert.
You
know, like I
like that.
I have my tendencies, which you describe. I can do well in group settings when I'm around people that I know. I generally avoid like large, big dinners. I want to have those one-on-one conversations with somebody. And if I'm with someone, I want to be able to give them all of my time and attention. When I'm around three or four people, I feel weird that I can't give everyone the attention that I would want to receive from, you know, that person.
Yeah, and also your time. I mean, I have this for sure also. Like when your time's at a premium and there's people you care about,
yeah,
like when you do see them, you want to see them.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and catch up and with each other. You know, it's a two-way street and all that stuff. Okay, so you have this fateful sabbatical,
yeah,
that comes up in your,
yeah,
life. And what's fascinating to me is the job you target to spend it on. It's a very normal first job in kitchens for teenagers.
Yeah.
Career changers, not so much.
Yeah.
But why don't you go ahead and explain, first of all, how the sabbatical came about and then the job that you went after. A lot of people probably just figured it out, but why don't you go ahead and tell that story.
You know, after, you know, Accenture offered a very generous sabbatical policy after you had been there for a certain amount of time, and you know, I took advantage of that opportunity and took 3 months off of work. I'd saved up, you know, a little bit of a nest egg and, you know, to make sure that I was set up. Had read Anthony Bourdain's book, read every book that I could possibly read about the industry, and then just knew that, you know, I had to get my foot in the door somehow. And the best way to get my foot in the door was go to any restaurant and just offer up your services for free. Someone with no experience in the kitchen, let alone the hospitality industry, I figured the best spot to start would be the dish pit. And no one's going to turn down free work, especially the dish pit. You know, I wanted to continue exploring my culture and my identity as a Vietnamese American. So I was very mindful of making sure that whatever, I was going to target opportunities that I knew would be advantageous for myself, knowing my background. I know about Vietnamese food. I know about Vietnamese culture. That would give me a leg up. So I targeted all the Vietnamese restaurants in New York City at the time. At that time, there were not that many Vietnamese restaurants. You had the Chinatown Vietnamese restaurants, which I love, but a modern Vietnamese restaurant really didn't exist so much at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember reading one of the Eater Plywood reports back in the day, and they were posting about this Vietnamese restaurant opening in Williamsburg. So I just cold emailed that individual and said, hey, I'm looking for a job. I'm willing to work in the dish pit. I'm willing to come in for free. He replied and gave me the opportunity, and I started in the dish pit there. And then like any other restaurant, you know, somebody's going to no show, no call. And I knew that would happen at some point. So I just spent my time doing the dishes, learning the system, you know, which was all new for me, and really aspired to master that dish pit. I thought I was able to do that and illustrate that I was a reliable individual. You know, I'm showing up to work every single day. I'm not doing anything dumb. I'm not drinking on the job. So when that person no show, no call, they gave me that one opportunity. And then I kind of never looked back after that.
To start doing, I assume initially it was prep?
Prep, garde manger.
Oh, you actually got on during service?
Yeah. So I quickly was able to, I think quickly my first spot was I would work the lunch services making banh mi's. So this was a Vietnamese spot on North Barry and 9th called Silent H. I started making sandwiches and then slowly graduated to working garde manger and kind of spent a year there working garde manger and just learning cold station and learning prep and just watching how this person just organized and ran their kitchen.
So wait, but the initial sabbatical was
3 months. Yeah.
3 months.
Yeah. So I did the 3 month sabbatical, went back to work a little bit longer just to continue building my nest egg, knowing that I was going to put my final notice in.
But a little bit longer was like, didn't you do like 9 more months or something like that?
I think it was
like,
6 to 9 months. I forget exact the time frame.
Was that torture?
No.
Having been like kind of activated on the cooking side?
Like I said, I knew my final goal. So like the kitchen life was, the hooks were already in. So I knew this was a means to an end. You know, I was also aware of the pay. You know, this is a time where I forgot what the minimum wage was then, but maybe $10 an hour. You know, so $10 an hour living in the East Village in a studio, that just, the numbers weren't going to add up.
So you had like a clock running in your head and you calibrated your patience and whatnot. Yeah. So it wasn't unbearable.
One thing my parents taught me is to be a good planner. So just foreseeing everything, planning everything. I knew I needed 9 months of runway just to earn some money, bank all that money. So however long I decide to be a line cook, I give myself that opportunity to not be stressed out about money. And also not taking a hit on my lifestyle at the time. You know, I'm here living in New York as a young person. I want to live that lifestyle and be able to enjoy it. So I went back to work at 6 or 9 months, can't remember. But yeah, something around that time frame, did my time and then went back to a Silent H. And then I think I did almost a full year there, just learning everything and just trying to continue to improve my skill set at the time.
Can you talk for another minute or so about the dish pit? I'm not going to actually do it with my hands, but you know, I applaud that notion, right? Because that is, I think, probably the most common point of entry into kitchens, often the path you're describing. You know, you do that and then you get this opportunity. You know, a lot of people who started like that have become great, very successful chefs and entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
Coming from this business background into this, I mean, you are there during service, but you know, it's a fairly solitary job.
Mm-hmm.
You're not on the line. You're not, I mean, a lot of times you're not gabbing that much on the line anyway, but you're kind of like a one man department, right? I mean, it's just such a 180 from everything, it seems to me, about the life you'd been leading professionally up until then. Did you love it from day one? Was it an acclimation? How hard was the job how hard was it for you to kind of find your stride and develop, you know, what Anthony Bourdain would call your moves, you know? Like, how long did it take you to kind of find your swing?
That's a great question. No one's really asked me that. You know, so like, I don't want to say I was on dish pit for an extended period of time. It was maybe 6 to 8 weeks. So I didn't spend too long in the dish pit, but it was definitely a learning curve, you know, like not working in the hospitality industry at all, having to learn how to run the dish pit, how to organize, how to set yourself up, how to work clean, all the fundamental building blocks of any successful line cook really starts at the dish pit. And I think it's something that if you have the opportunity as a young person and you have an interest in this field, it's something that, you know, I don't think should be looked down upon. I think it's a great first step for anyone to really just see if you can really, if this really resonates with you or not. Because if you can't handle the dish pit and you can't take pride in keeping a clean, organized dish pit, you're not going to take pride in at your station and your box and keeping it clean and organized all the time. And it's something that I wish all of my cooks had the opportunity to do, is really start from that dish pit and learn from the ground up. Because really, you know, honestly, I think the dish pit is the most important part of our restaurant. It all kind of, everything happens there. That person is one of the most important members of our team. And it's such an underappreciated role and station. I learned so much from the dish pit that, you know, has translated to the rest of my time as a chef and as a line cook. You know,
yeah, I mean, this comes up all the time. I mean, certainly among non-industry people, it's a job that most people aren't even like, think about ever, you know. And but I can't tell you how many chefs have said to me, you know, if the dish pit goes down or falls behind, you're hosed.
Yeah,
serve it, you're toast.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it's an amazing thing. I think I know more chefs who have kept dishwashers with them from job to job than have like kept like sous chefs with them from job. I mean, I know people who've had those relationships for literally for decades.
Yeah, you know, it's like I said, they're their eyes, they're the ears of the chef. They see everything. They see the plates coming back. They know if this stuff's not getting eaten, if something's going on. Having a solid person on the dish pit that you trust and can rely on, worth their weight in gold.
Helps 100%. You sleep at night.
Yeah, exactly.
At what point do you start thinking of yourself as an aspiring chef? Someone who wants to have their own menu, potentially be a chef owner, you know, or a co-owner. When do you start envisioning yourself in that way?
You know, my story, it's a bit of a charm story, you know, because a lot of things kind of went the right way for me coming up, you know, I look at some of my peers and what they've had to go through to attain the level where they're at. They spent many years in the industry working their way up through the ranks. And for myself, you know, like I said, going back to, you know, when I started this journey in the cooking industry, you know, I made sure I played to my strengths. So, you know, I wanted to only work in Vietnamese food because while I didn't have the technical skills to cook, I at least knew the food, I knew the culture, and I knew everything about it. So, to, you know, to answer your question, when did I start seeing the vision of, like, I'm going to be a chef owner? That came much later on, you know. That didn't come until after I actually became a chef. You know, like, I thought I was just going to be a line cook for the next 10 years because...
10 years, really?
Yeah, because that's the way I read in books. You have to be a line cook for 10 years. You got to go travel. You got to do all these things before you think you can become a chef.
But don't you feel I'm asking you legitimately, and yeah. I'm not disagreeing with you, but yeah. Like I feel like that's a slightly at this point in time old school
100%
attitude.
Yeah.
Like, do the people who come work for you want to be doing what that?
No,
they want. Everyone wants to be a chef by the time they're 30.
Absolutely.
And I don't say that as a criticism, but times have changed.
100%. Times have changed. I've had to adjust. Expectations have changed, and I think it's good. I think these are good things in our industry that are happening.
But when you set out, your expectation was 10 years.
Yeah, and that wasn't that long ago. You know, we're talking about, you know, 13 years ago. But my expectation was, okay, and now I'm a line cook here. I've got 7 to 10 years of being a line cook where I'm going to feel comfortable having attained all the knowledge. I'll have had the opportunity to see everything that can possibly happen. And I need to do all of this before I can graduate and even think about becoming a chef. I need to go work for someone else and understand what it means to be a chef before I become a chef. Now, my story does not follow that.
Right.
Coincidentally, I end up meeting, you know, my current business partner now when he was thinking about opening his restaurant, Anchoy, and just good timing and, you know, a fortunate meeting, you know, and us being both very inexperienced, we both decide to embark on this journey together to open a restaurant. And hence, I become a chef only after maybe 2 years, maybe 2 years in the industry. And at that point, I've only been a line cook and I've only been working Gare Manger cold station. I hadn't even graduated saute yet. I've seen it, I've worked it a little bit, but I hadn't worked the saute station yet.
So I'm going to just speak totally brutally, honestly, right? I hear that. And I think you had the perspective of this is going to be a 10-year process to even think about being a chef. You know, you've lived a while at this point. Yeah. You're not a kid.
Yeah.
You've been in a profession in which you paid your dues, whatever you want to call it, worked your way up the ladder. You know, we're at a point where you were eligible for like the next level of management. Yeah. Like, why didn't you stop yourself at that moment? Like, when you look back, does it seem strange that you were given that opportunity and that you took it?
100%.
To both, yes.
I remember getting the call from my partner, Tuan. I was in Seattle visiting some friends. I was telling my friends, I was like, yeah, I'm not going to get this job. Like, it's obvious I'm inexperienced. Why would anyone's right mind hire someone that has only been in the industry for this long? So I was shocked to get that call. Like, hey, you got the job. You know, this is next steps. And we're going on this journey together. You know, I think being naive, being young, but also you move to New York to take on those kind of opportunities. You move to New York to take risks, not knowing what was ahead of me and how difficult it would be and how many losses I would take. I didn't think much of it at the time. So I was very enthusiastic to take on the opportunity. But yes, with perspective and looking back at it now, it's crazy to think that myself and my partner, Tuan, who at that time as well, had only been a host at Pastis and had never otherwise been associated with the hospitality industry in general, for him to be a first-time operator and for me to be a first-time chef to open a restaurant in the Lower East Side, it was crazy. You know, I think it was just a situation where ignorance was bliss. You know, we didn't know what was ahead of us. All we knew was that we were going to work hard, and it was one of the most difficult experiences I've ever had to deal with in my life. But, you know, we got through it, and it's an amazing story when I think about it, you know, when I reflect about, you know, our journey together.
What did you do well in that? Let's focus for a minute on the positive side. Yeah. Like, what did you do well? Were you proud of the menu you put together there? Like, what do you feel like you did well right out of the box?
You know, I think, like I said, you know, I was proud of what we were trying to do. I didn't think the food was anything to write home about. But at that time, what we had going for us was my partner, Tuan, had a vision. There were a lot of Chinatown Vietnamese restaurants. Vietnamese food still wasn't something that was very well known. So banh mi's and pho's was still very new and exciting for a lot of people. And we were kind of at the forefront of that. You know, we were the first place to kind of offer it in a setting that was comfortable, a place that you'd want to take a date, a place that you want to spend some time at. Immediately from the jump, we were very busy.
You were filling a need that no one else had perceived.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, just leveraging all the things that I was very familiar with, that I grew up eating, and just being a good steward about it and introducing New Yorkers to it, you know, and then just having a beautiful space that was interesting and had a vibe. Just those two combinations alone enabled us to get a nice press bump, and we were very busy from the beginning.
So that saw you through to some extent.
Yeah, that saw us through. Now,
before you say what you're going to say, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just think this is such a valuable thing for young cooks who listen to the show, of which there are many. And I don't talk about it much on the show, but, you know, and it is interesting to me what you just said, juxtaposed with what you described about Tian Ho and sambar, right? Because I think if you look at a lot of what's really captured diners' imaginations over the last 15, 20 years, it is chefs tapping into something that maybe seems almost idiosyncratic or eccentric. Definitely a lot of the time something that ties into their personal heritage.
Sure.
But which at the moment they appear, right, is almost shocking. You know, David Chang's one of the most successful visible chefs on the planet, right? When that noodle bar opened, that was shocking. This was someone who'd worked for like Daniel Boulud.
Yeah.
And people were like, what?
Yeah.
And then it had all this heat all of a sudden, right? And but there's a number of chefs who have found great success doing something, following a path that maybe only they could see. Mm-hmm. You're nodding as I say this. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if you could speak to this for a moment, because I, you know, when I do like panels or something like that at a school or something, and if I ever get asked, it's kind of a dumb question for general advice. I always say, be aware of what turns you on, and don't worry about whether or not it's turned anyone else on before you, or there's anything, any restaurant that offers it already. Just if it just lights you up, that's probably significant.
Yeah, I would 100% agree with that.
Can you just speak to this for a minute? I think this is something that's very difficult for a lot of people to just naturally know, because it's counterintuitive.
I would attribute all my success to, it's not that I'm technically better than anyone, I can cook better than anyone. I like to share what I enjoy. I'm true to myself. So Vietnamese food, obviously, something that I appreciate and enjoy, something that I want to share with people. It's something that's very true to myself. It's very easy for me to create a menu, to think of dishes, because they're things that I commonly would eat, things that I see, things that I've enjoyed with my family or my friends. So it's a very easy path forward to think of these things and share these things. And I found in my career, whether it's Vietnamese food or whether it's my other business that I had when I started cooking Vietnamese food, you know, I had a smoked brisket business. And that was just leveraging things that I've enjoyed that was true to me. I grew up in Texas eating barbecue. Barbecue wasn't very big here in New York at the time, and I saw an opportunity, and I stayed true to myself. And I just kind of mined my past experiences, the things that I enjoy, and realized that if I just be true to myself and share the things that I really enjoy, more often than not, people are going to resonate with that. And if you have that enthusiasm and it shows through your food, it doesn't matter what hot trend or what is hot right now, that will always resonate with people. People will be able to see that through everything else. I think that can be complicated as a young cook because you kind of want to follow the trends. And I think you can be self-conscious and doubt yourself about, well, you know, I like this, but everybody else is doing this.
Yeah, there's a reason we have these dishes that everyone, you know, become jokes, right? Like the avocado toast.
Yeah.
There's a reason everyone had the avocado toast because it sold.
Yeah.
When people looked at your menu online, that was like a little like thing they could like lock onto that was familiar.
Yeah.
And grounding, right?
Yeah.
I interrupted you before. You said, you talked about the concept and the vibe, and then you said, that being said, and I jumped in.
Oh, right.
You were about to give me the flip side.
Yeah. So, you know, we had that great first push, but, you know, just talking about our journey, because I think it's important to show, you know, the failures, you know, and, you know, after we got to that first push and that first wave of interest and excitement, quickly, you know, my inexperience started to show, you know, and I'll give you an example of my inexperience. I've spoken this about before. I didn't even know what a hotel pan was. I saw those pans, but I couldn't even communicate to my team, oh, that's the pan that we need, the six pans, et cetera, et cetera. I knew where we were at, and I couldn't get us past that point anymore. And I was starting to feel really burned out, and I was starting to doubt myself quite a bit. And then sales started to slump.
Was it hard to hold on to cooks?
Yeah, 100%. The inflection point was, I think everyone started to sense that, oh, this guy doesn't really know what he's doing. He's not a real chef.
Well, so, you tell that hotel pan story, and I'm like, oof.
Yeah.
Like that could cause you instant loss of, right? That's an instant hit that you have to recover from.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And not even a technical thing. I also didn't have the leadership ability. I didn't have the leadership experience. Being a chef is more than just about cooking. You have to lead men and women, and you have to do it in a way that's consistent, that's even, and that can be very complicated when you're also having to deal with a restaurant, menu, et cetera, et cetera. So I was just woefully unprepared for the challenges that were ahead of me. And I was getting to a point where I was actually considering going back to consulting. I was considering resigning my position because I saw what was ahead. I was already killing myself working, but there was no one around to give me any mentorship. I was not able to learn. The internet was there, but it wasn't what it was then, so I couldn't just go on YouTube and look all these things up like you can now.
Right. Like put yourself through a crash course. Yeah.
You know, so at one point, my entire kitchen staff walked out on me. I totally agreed with them in retrospect because I was a shitty leader. I was a shitty boss.
What was it like for you? I almost want to say minute to minute. I was going to say like when you went home at night. I mean, you're someone who, you know, you grow up with parents who put a premium on like education and success.
Yeah.
You have a successful business career. You're clearly someone who's pretty buttoned down and together. You're failing.
Yeah.
You're not competent in your job at this time, right, that you're describing. I mean, I feel like I relate to you on a couple of levels. This is one of them. I would feel just perpetually like at a spiritual crisis almost. What was it like to be in your head day to day, end of the day, wake up in the morning, you know, having to like get dressed and go do it again when you knew that you weren't really ready for that?
Yeah, I kind of threw myself into the work, which a lot of people do just to not think about my feelings as much. But you're right. That was one of the most difficult times of my life. I felt like I was letting down my partner, Tuan, who had invested, you know, his life savings in this. And I could see the ship starting to sink. And I could see the financial stresses on his face. And I could see, like I said, the stresses I was putting on my team at the time. And they knew that I was not capable and fit to be leading this team of people. So, it was one of the most darkest and difficult times of my very young professional career at the time. But I'm so thankful I went through it, you know, and it was, you know, it builds character. But, it, you know, I got to learn a lot about myself and also, you know, realize that you're going to have those up and downs. You're going to have those swings in life. Thank God I stuck with it and I didn't resign and go back to doing what I was doing. But I was pretty close. You know, it was...
Yeah. So when you look at that like sliding doors moment, right?
Yeah.
Like that other path, I assume that you if you, you know, extrapolated into the future, you would see a very unhappy, dissatisfied, maybe bitter Dennis, right, in the future. Did you have the perspective at that point to realize that it was a crisis of timing and not necessarily anything else? Like when you describe this moment to me, it just seems like you got that job too soon. Did you have the perspective? I mean, yes, you had a mountain to climb, right? But did you know that like it wasn't like you didn't have the goods or you weren't capable? You know, it wasn't that you weren't capable. It was just that maybe you needed to have some more experience and knowledge before taking a position like that.
Yeah, you definitely needed more seasoning. Definitely needed more experience.
But you recognized that.
Absolutely.
You didn't see it as like permanent doom.
No, you know, obviously I knew that I had the work ethic, but I guess I didn't know how to apply that work ethic. I didn't know how to use my time and manage my time. All those leadership characteristics, I did not have quite yet. I knew how to apply them in a different setting, in a professional corporate setting, but this setting where it's very, you know, your hands are in every single thing and everyone's coming to you with questions and people rely on you to give them the answers, I wasn't prepared for that quite yet. I was still too young in my career to provide that knowledge and insight to my teams. And, you know, I was a little burnt out. You know, like I had been put through the ringer now, you know, to open up the place and then go through a year of it that I started questioning whether or not this would be the right career path and the right move for myself, and maybe I should go back and kind of reconsider what my next moves were.
I know you've talked about this person before, this person who rides in on a white horse. Yeah. You've been very discreet about their identity.
Yeah.
But can you just briefly tell the story of this kind of like retroactive mentor who comes into your life?
Yeah,
one of the most amazing things I've ever heard.
Yeah, you know, I love sharing the story. It almost sounds not true and just made up, but you know, it actually did happen.
Or imagined.
Yeah, imagined. you know, so the entire kitchen staff walks out on me specifically. Have no kitchen staff, so we have to close the next day, and we put up a Craigslist ad, and then we just wait. We had just gotten an article in the 25 and under column in the New York Times, so we had a little bit of press going for us, and I remember this individual walking in. We're just waiting. So no one shows up for the interview, by the way. And then right before we're about to pack up and close, this individual walks in, and he's like, hey, why are you guys closed? And we're like, well, we're looking for a cook. And he's like, well, I'm a cook.
You know, and this is someone we should say you would place at the time, like in their 60s, I've heard you say.
He looked like he was in his 60s. And he's like, yeah, I'm a cook. And I look at Twan, we're like, okay. He's like, I was going to the pickle store next door and I read about you guys and really wanted to come eat. And well, I was like, well, you know, I'm sorry. Can't do anything about it right now. I'm looking for cooks. And then he's like, well, I have my knives and I have a change. You know, I have my clothes on me. I'll change and we'll go down to Chinatown and I'll cook you guys a meal. And just... at that time, I was like, oh, my God, this guy's coming to steal my job, which kind of gave me some relief because I was like, okay, at least.
You thought maybe he had heard what happened and was like.
And maybe this will be good for Twan. And I'll feel a little bit better about the situation because if I don't work out, at least we got this guy. So he proceeds to take me to Chinatown and we go shop and he cooks us a 3-course meal.
Like right at his home?
No, in the restaurant.
Back to your restaurant.
Yeah, go back to the restaurant and he cooks us a 3-course meal, just blown away by how simple it is, but how delicious it was. And he was able to do this stuff all on the fly, no planning. We were just amazed. And, you know, like we offer him the job and he kindly accepts. And then from that day on starts my mentorship with that individual. And I worked with that individual day in and day out for the next couple of years. And I attribute everything I've learned now to him, and all my success is to him. We named our LLC after him. You know, I don't know how long, you know, I could go on and on about this individual because as crazy as it was and how he came into my life and as much information and knowledge that he passed on to me, he also, in mysterious ways, left our lives. You know, one day he just never showed up again.
Oh, is that what happened?
Yeah. We were paying him cash, didn't really have any of his personal information besides his phone number. The only way you could call him if he wasn't at his work was you had to schedule the phone call with him. Otherwise, he wasn't going to pick up the phone. And then one day, you know, I had a meeting with him. And this is after I had left the restaurant. So after I left, so, you know, we worked together for the next, I think it was like almost 5 years together, very closely. And then we righted the ship until it became very successful. And then, you know, Twan, my partner, recently had to close Anchoi during COVID, but it had a very long run.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, kind of helped anchor Orchard Street into what it has become today. So really proud of the work we did there. But, you know, as suddenly as he came into our lives, he left our lives in very mysterious fashion as well. And I think about him often still, just because I don't know where he went and never had an opportunity to speak to him again, even an opportunity to thank him for like everything he gave me and how much of an impact he was on my life. And I do have mixed feelings about it, you know, and something that I don't know if I've ever really reconciled for myself, because it was a very hurtful way he left. You know, he borrowed a little bit of money from me, didn't get my money back, and then now he's gone. It was very strange to kind of reconcile that, because he also gave me everything I have now, all the knowledge he provided for me. He saved me from going back to this other career path and really cemented me down this career path that I'm in right now.
It's such a... I didn't know that's how it had ended.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, it kind of checks out, though, right? Someone at that age, that capable, not a chef in their own right, wandering in unattached, able to just, like, commit on the spot, and then, you know, disappearing into the sunset. You know, who knows why? But it does kind of seem, in a way, bizarrely consistent with... the way the story ended seems consistent with how it started.
Yeah, 100%.
Right?
Yeah.
Strangely.
Yeah.
I hope at some point maybe, you must imagine here, you know, this person showing up one night for dinner or something.
I thought he would have shown up when we opened D&D, because we had so much buzz leading up to the restaurant that, you know, he's obviously very knowledgeable about the food industry and the hospitality scene. So was hoping that he might show up for that. Obviously, I still have his phone number. So it's it would be very easy to figure all this stuff out. To, you know, I've called the number a couple times to never get an answer. I'm sure I could just do a reverse trace and figure out. But, you know, I think it's a story left that I think ended the way it should end at this point. And it's better, I think, better that, you know, I don't know what happened. If he wants to resume that relationship, he knows where to find
us. What I was just going to say. It's clearly the way he wants it.
Yeah. I think for us, it's best left to leave it this way and respect how the relationship ended. However way I feel about it and how I feel about it and how it, you know, it did damage me a little bit, but I think the price I paid for that, it was worth it at the end.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing all that.
Yeah.
So tell me about D&D. How does this restaurant come about? First of all, tell people, I love it, what the name of the restaurant means.
So it means let's go eat, a fun way of saying let's go eat amongst friends and family. So after Enchoy, you know, I started to do the outdoor markets. So I started a smoked brisket business, and I was doing the smorgasburg, Brooklyn fleecing.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for another 5 years, and I got really deep into the catering scene. Really enjoyed that, had a great run doing that, but then started to realize I missed the team aspect of working in a restaurant. I missed the service. I missed the adrenaline rush of service. So the draw of opening a restaurant, I've never, you know, had my own restaurant. And like I said, really for me, it was, I really missed working with a team of people that we're all like-minded. We have the same ideas. We have the same goals. And I find I'm much better as part of a team as opposed to being working by myself. And, you know, the catering stuff was great from a financial perspective, but it's the same stuff over and over and over and over again. So I was also missing the creative aspect. You know, I kept a good relationship with Tuan after I had left Anchoy and put it in his ear that, you know, I was looking to do something on the scale of opening a restaurant. And, you know, we danced back and forth for a little bit, but, you know, the timing worked out and we decided to open a restaurant and, you know, looked around at different areas and kind of settled on Greenpoint where we're at right now.
What was this space before this?
So it's been many different places. I'm trying to think. It was, I forgot the name, but it was run by, well, she's, you know, she's a very big YouTube cooking personality now. So she and her husband used to have a restaurant here. It was a diner.
Okay.
It was pretty short-lived, I think maybe a year.
Okay.
But they did diner style food, but just really in their vision.
Mm-hmm.
But it had been a string of restaurants previously. So, but they were the most recent operator.
It's got a great vibe.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked before I came in. I embarrassingly have not been here to eat yet. I'll remedy that soon.
Yeah.
But it's three rooms.
Yeah.
It's kind of railroad apartment style. Mm-hmm. One room flows into the next. The central room has great light and the open kitchen. And this room has the bar. And then there's another room in the very back. But it's got a great kind of natural flow energy to it. And I'm saying that sitting here as it's empty.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, really great bones. You know, when I walked into this space, you know, we looked at many spaces, you know, just instantly fell in love with all the natural light. Having been in the industry now and worked in a lot of basements with no natural light, fluorescent light, I just saw, like, I want this spot. I want to be able to work in natural light. You know, if I'm going to be here 10 to 12 hours a day, I got to have some sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to make it comfortable for myself and my team just so we feel good about all the time we're spending here. We've been here for 5 years now and really appreciative of what we've been able to start and what I've seen blossom in terms of the Vietnamese community of restaurateurs and operators that have opened up in the last, you know, 5 years since we've opened up. You know, I'd like to think that Enchoy was kind of version 1.0 of Vietnamese food, and now we're starting to graduate to version 2.0, which isn't necessarily just banh mi and pho anymore. And we're starting to see what a lot of the bigger cities that have large Vietnamese populations, you're seeing operators and chefs start to specialize in certain things. And it's great for the dining public here in New York because you're starting to see things that you wouldn't necessarily see previously. And it's really fun and exciting right now to be able to share all these wonderful things that you know, are very commonplace to myself. But when I see guests coming to eat these dishes that are very new and exciting to them, you know, it's really very fulfilling, and it makes me really appreciate what I get to be able to do day in and day out here, given how difficult this year has been for all of us.
Before we wrap up, I know it's like asking someone to pick their favorite kid or something. So I'm not your favorite, but if you were going to pick one or two things that you guys do here that you feel kind of epitomizes D&D, like what it is, what you do, what you kind of your mission is, to use a word you probably don't use much since your corporate days. But like, what would it be? One or two things that you feel kind of sum up what you guys are about here.
I'll correct you again as well. Mission is something we use a lot these days, especially in this day and age. For someone to come work at a restaurant, I feel like especially, you know, everything that's happened this past year, just providing a salary is not enough. You know, just providing a job is not enough. If we want to attract people, we got to have a good mission statement that resonates with people. And, you know, part of our mission statement is, we want to be good stewards of Vietnamese cuisine and food and represent our culture well. But, you know, part of our mission statement is also to be a good member of our community here in Greenpoint and supporting people and organizations that impact people's lives here in Greenpoint. So mission is a word that we use a lot these days about what we want D&D to be in the future and how our mission statement can help differentiate ourselves and attract people to come work with us. Because, like I said, we have to be more than just a restaurant. Mm-hmm. We got to be someone that's part of our community in order to, I think, be successful and attract the people that we want to have work with us.
Thank you for the correction.
Yeah. But to answer your question, two dishes that I think represent what we do, because, you know, to me, like, there's a creative aspect of what we do, but I really like to look at what we do as we're trying to be good stewards of the cuisine. The things that we do, we're not reinventing the wheel. My first goal is to be a good steward of the cuisine. And my second goal, whenever we come up with dishes, is to realize who we are as a team. We're not a team that is 100% Vietnamese. There's maybe only 3 or 4 people on our team right now that are Vietnamese. Everyone else comes from different backgrounds, different cultures, different experiences cooking. My job as a chef and as an operator is to play to their strengths. I'm their coach. I can cook the dishes that are very close to me that I know people would enjoy. But then, you know, like I said, I don't think my team, while they would do it and they would happily do it, I don't think that's playing to the strengths of my team. And I don't think that helps get them involved in the process. I think one of the benefits for myself as a chef has been my exposure in different industries and how I think about how I utilize my team. I think I got to get a lot of credit because I learned about this when I was working as a consultant and how to leverage my teammates and our teams to do our jobs. And if I'm going to be successful, I need to leverage the talents of my team. And our process is very collaborative. So, you know, to the two dishes that I think represent us, you know, one dish, our most popular dish is our pho thin. You know, it's a variation of pho. It's from a pho shop in Hanoi on Thin Street. And they do a variation of pho with wok seared beef and an egg yolk, super delicious. So we took homage to that, and we were very good steward of that dish, and we have that on our dish now on our menu, and it's one of our most popular dishes that will never leave our menu. But another dish I think that represents us very well, kind of plays into my Vietnamese American heritage, but also leveraging the talents of my team. So we do a version of chicken and rice. Every culture has chicken and rice in some capacity. But our chicken and rice, while being very Vietnamese, leverages everyone's experiences and tastes and preferences, being as New Yorkers, being as people that have cooked in New York. So our version of chicken and rice, you know, it's a leg and thigh. It's stuffed with lemongrass and chili, but it's glazed in this barbecue sauce, I like to call it. So it kind of plays off of our interest in barbecue, our interest in people's experiences cooking barbecue. There's also a white sauce on there. It plays on our love of like halal food and the chicken and rice dish. There's crispy rice on there, you know, plays on our love of just like things of crispy. If you look at that dish, there's components of it that are Vietnamese. My mom saw it, she would not think that's a Vietnamese dish, but it kind of highlights everyone's experiences in my kitchen. And we've all kind of like taken our backgrounds, things that we enjoy, and we've kind of filtered it down and worked collaboratively on it to put this dish that is very Vietnamese American that we're all proud of and has all our fingerprints on, but is still to me a very good steward and representation of where we're at as a team. And we continue to move towards cooking based on of our experiences and our backgrounds. So we're always going to have these dishes that reference Vietnam, things that pay homage to the stuff that we enjoy in Vietnam. But as our team grows more diverse and as the founding members move on to different projects, even myself, as we start to think about what our next project is, my job is to set that kind of sandbox for my team to understand, okay, we're playing in the Vietnamese sandbox, but I know you're not Vietnamese. I know you don't have that same experience and that same upbringing of having the closeness to this food. It's okay. You don't need to have that experience. You don't need to have that deep level knowledge. But take that experience as you've had as a chef, cooking Spanish food, cooking Mexican food. There's still ways to incorporate that together in a cohesive way that still is very reflective of Vietnamese food, but is still very reflective of us. And that will still make it authentic to us. And that's what concerns me the most these days. I'm not concerned necessarily more about being authentic to Vietnam, because if I play that game, I'm always gonna lose. There's always gonna be someone coming in that's saying, this is not authentic, this is not how my mom makes it, and you're right. I'm not gonna be able to make it as good as your mom.
Or maybe they grew up there.
And yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I can still make things that are authentic, and this is the way that I think I can make things that are authentic to us that is representative of where we're at. We're here in Greenpoint. We're here in Brooklyn. We don't have access to the things we would have in Vietnam. We still have a very small Vietnamese population here, so we don't have the access to the pantry that you would have in Houston or the other places. And that just, I think, speaks to getting older and being more comfortable in my skin and knowing that in order for us to succeed, I've got to play to the strengths of my team.
And that's our show for today. Again, my great thanks to Dennis Ngo. Please do support his restaurant, D on D, in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, in New York. I'm looking forward to dining there very soon myself. And again, the Destination Dining program will continue at D on D and also at Night Market in Los Angeles through next Friday, November 5th, 2021. Andrew Talks to Chefs is produced by Table 12 Productions. The show is written, booked, edited, mixed, and hosted by me, Andrew Friedman. If you would like to support us, we ask you do that by telling a friend, posting about the show on social media, rating or especially reviewing us at Apple Podcasts, which does help new listeners discover the show. Our thanks as always to After School Special for our music. Please check out their album, Double Barrel, Single Entendre on iTunes. Please follow us on Instagram. The handle there is @ChefPodcast. Thank you for listening, and we will see you back next week with another episode or two of Andrew Talks to Chefs.